good day wherever you may be. Welcome to Observations. I'm here alone today. Scott is taking care of business, and Kirk has company in town. And I'd like to begin with four items in the news before we turn back to the story of Dodd. The first is I don't know if it was a Twitter or a tweet, but I understand it that Trump today proclaimed that he was completely exonerated during the Comey testimony. And I just want to know how it is possible for somebody to be completely exonerated when the former head of the FBI said that you routinely lied, that he took notes during the meeting and immediately after each meeting transferred everything that had been discussed to writing because he did not trust you. And yet, in Trump's warped mind, that is total exoneration. You know, to be exonerated means that you told the truth. The truth is consistent with your position. And exactly the opposite was true. The next thing is also pertaining to the Comey meeting with the Congress. I don't know if any of you may have had the opportunity to do two things. One is to read Comey's written statement. If you do, you'd be horrified as to what he had to say about Donald Trump. But did anyone listen to John McCain's attempt to question Comey? I mean, if it was so bad that Comey just looked at him and said, you know, is there a question coming here? Is there anything that is sane that is going to be said here? Are you capable of stating a rational thought? I don't know if John McCain is finally reached senility. I don't know if he is ill, has Alzheimer's, or was drunk or drugged. I don't know. But I can tell you for certain that that man has no business acting as a senator of the United States. The third item in the news is really interesting. Muslims are at political war with one another. There is now growing a blockade around Qatar. Now, Qatar is an really interesting place in the sense that Qatar, and I've spoken of it through the Shattering Myths programs for years, Qatar was the epicenter of gun running to the jihadist world. The emir of Qatar did something that was reasonably smart. He recognized that there was a limit to the amount of black ooze they would be able to drain out of the soils beneath his fiefdom, small as it was, and he used the revenues that he had generated thus far to pay Western companies to build a liquid gas or a natural gas liquefaction plant so that natural gas could be transported to other countries. And so, since natural gas is extraordinarily prevalent there, as it is in many places around the world, the liquefaction process enabled him to continue to generate enormous revenues and sales to Europe and other countries. So, he took the profits that he was garnering from the sale of liquefied natural gas and bought weapons from around the world. And he provided those weapons. For the first time that we saw them in bulk was in Libya. You know, when the first pictures of Libya were right after Obama and McCain collectively said that we have to do away with Gaddafi and let's bomb him into oblivion, What we saw was jihadi groups, which were wrongly identified as freedom fighters, running around in pickup trucks with 50 cal machine guns in the back. They had anti-aircraft guns in the back of pickup trucks. Everybody and their brother was carrying automatic weapons. There were anti-tank weapons. There were surface-to-air missiles, rocket-propelled grenade launchers. And these were so prevalent that the first question is, where in the world did these come from? Gaddafi was a dictator. Dictators do not allow their opposition, and Gaddafi was actually opposed to fundamentalist Islamic terrorist groups, to run around armed to the teeth. And it quickly became apparent that America had supplied the weapons to Qatar, and Qatar had used them, had deployed them, had sent them to Libya. And what has happened since then? Well, that miscalculation, the removal of Gaddafi, who was a strange, syphilitic, pajama-wearing lunatic, not a very good man, in fact, a horrible man, but infinitely better than that which has replaced him, because now in Libya, there is nothing but chaos. Warring gangs of Islamic jihadists, all armed to the eyeballs, killing one another. Those guns came from Qatar. Then we saw the events in Syria, where we wondered how it was that al-Nusra, which is a name we don't hear very much anymore, but al-Nusra was the first amalgamation of Sunni jihadist groups that sought to bring down the Assad government. They were also armed to the teeth, and they were using the same kind of weapons. They had anti-tank weapons. They had surface-to-air missiles. In fact, they had artillery. And you wonder, how is it possible that jihadi groups could have such weapons? Well, the same source. They came from Qatar. And now Qatar is not just a little oasis in the Islamic Middle East, like so many of these little personal fiefdoms. It is also the home of the U.S. naval fleet, one of the largest air bases and naval bases in the world, which is probably why Trump took the opposite side of Saudi Arabia and Kuwait et al. And said, we're going to embrace Qatar, even though they are the primary weapons suppliers to Islamic terrorists worldwide. But this rift between them, where the people in Qatar don't eat. They have all the natural gas in the world, but they have no way of bringing people in, getting people out, and most especially getting food to their people without trade deals. And it's all being shut down. It'll be interesting to see how this plays out in terms of yet another rift of their hand shall be against their brother and their brother's hand shall be against them, and they shall live in hostility with all the world. One last thought on the news. I think it was 3 days ago, the New York Times printed a prominent editorial, and it essentially said it's time to leave Afghanistan. And they went through the fact that that even with tens of thousands of U.S. troops, we were not able to achieve the goal of ousting the Taliban. The Taliban now controls large swaths of Afghanistan. They're very popular in the places where they are in control. And that the biggest problem is that not only could we not oust the Taliban, and Al-Qaeda was never a meaningful presence in Afghanistan, but that the Afghanis flat out do not want what we want them to want. As Muslims, they don't want to educate women. They don't want freedom. They don't want democracy. They do not want what we want, no matter how badly We want to give it to them. And therefore, since no amount of arms, no amount of training, no amount of U.S. bombing, no amount of U.S. special force intervention, not even multiples of the mothers of all bombs, is going to change the reality that Afghanistan is a lose-lose proposition. And I've been saying that now since before we invaded Afghanistan, that there was no way to prevail. That so long as Islam exists there, we cannot leave it better than we found it. And now, what, 16 years after that invasion, the New York Times is finally saying the responsible thing. We cannot prevail. There is no way to win. It doesn't matter how many troops we send, how many weapons we supply, or how long we stay. Afghanistan is a lost cause. Now, what that means, of course, is George Bush made a stupid decision. He was wrong. And sometimes, folks, when we're wrong, there's only one correct thing to do, and that's admit it. And that's something the United States seems incapable of doing, which is something this article also presented. Now I'd like to turn back to the passages we were considering in Chronicles, which is words for words of the time, Dabari Ha Yomem, and consider what we can learn about Daoud. I'm convinced, and feel free to disagree, but I'm convinced personally that Daoud is the most interesting character presented in the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms. We know that there's no one God loved more. There's no one who wrote more prolifically on behalf of God. And so when you recognize that this man, by his very life and God's statements regarding him, completely destroys the myth of the addition that's been placed upon the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms, the so-called Christian New Testament, completely obliterating the basis of Pauline doctrine, that if you violate any one aspect of the Torah, you're guilty of violating all of them. As Paul wrote in Galatians, that the Torah cannot save. Well, Daoud was a bad boy. His behavior was consistently in violation of the Torah's instructions. He did not obey the Torah. And yet Yahweh said, he's righteous. He's right by me. He's vindicated. Which, in and of itself, disproves the very premise of Pauline Christianity. But this man I find to be more interesting, more enlightening, more enriching than any other. And so we're going to spend a little more time learning what there is to know about him. This then picks up the story in Dabari Ha Yomem, Words of Our Time, 1 Chronicles 15:1. And it reads, he, speaking of Daoud, engaged to build houses for himself in the city of Daoud. And he firmly established a place for the Ark of God to stand, pitching and spreading out a tent for it. Now, this story would just be okay. So Daoud built some houses. He built the houses in a place called the City of Daoud. And Daoud, by the way, is David. There is no V in Hebrew. And there is no vowel between the W, which is because it's written D-W-D, between the W and the concluding D. So it's just Daoud. And it's written D-W-D all but one times of the hundreds and hundreds of times it appears the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms. So I'm fairly convinced that God knows how to spell his most beloved son's name. So this begins by saying that Daoud engaged to build houses. And they built houses for himself in the city of Daoud. What is the biggest complaint against Israel today? Why is it that Israel is condemned in world bodies around the world? What are they doing? Building houses. They're building houses for themselves. Where? In Jerusalem. Where is the city of Dode? It is Jerusalem. Jerusalem and the city of Dode are one and the same. We know where Dode's home was. The foundations are still visible. It's on the trailing edge, the southern tip of the ridgeline of Moriah, which sits in the heart of Jerusalem. Right up from Dode's home is the Temple Mount. Right up from there is the summit of Mount Moriah, where Abraham and Yitzhak met with Yahweh. And so Dode did what Israelites are doing today. He built homes. You do not find here God saying, oh my goodness, what are you doing? This is my land. What are you doing building homes on it? No, God thought it was just fine that he built homes there. In fact, any rational person would think that building homes on land is a good use of that land so that you can take care of and nurture your family, protect your family. But what the world is enraged at Israel for doing this very thing. And they will embrace this mythical people who call themselves Palestinians who act as terrorists. Terror, fine. Building homes, can't have that, can we? So he engaged to build houses for himself in the city of Dode. And he firmly established a place for the Ark of God to stand. The Ark of God to stand. This is Makum La Aaron Ha Elohim. Makum is an office. It's a site. It's a dwelling place. It's a home. It's a place to take a stand. This is where God stood up for us so that we could stand with him. Makum. It's based on what stand, ma, and kum. Kum is, we've heard of the old campfire slogan, kumbaya. Kum means stand, ba is with, and ya is Yahweh's name. Kumbaya, this is makum, la Aaron. Aaron is the word that Yahweh uses to describe the Ark of the Covenant. Now, it's the Ark of the Covenant, which comprises a mercy seat. It is interesting that this Ark, which houses the 10 statements that Yahweh etched in stone, and those statements are profoundly important. They introduce God by name, tell us that you will not exist with him if you associate with any other God, like Allah or Jesus Christ. Or the Lord. And it goes on to say that God is strongly opposed to being religious, to going to religious places, to one corrupting their children with religion. And in that second statement that he etched in stone, he says that the thousands, which is one in a million, will benefit from his mercy, receive his mercy by observing the terms and conditions of his covenant. The third statement etched in stone on that first tablet is profound. It says that belittling, negating the importance of, deceiving people regarding Yahweh's name is unforgivable. And that means that every person in every religion is in a position where they cannot be forgiven. Because in Christianity, there is no reference to Yahweh's name. Now they replace it with the Lord, which is Satan's title. They replace it with Jesus or Christ or Jesus Christ. Or Allah in the case of Islam. That is the ultimate negation of his name. You know, you read the Torah, the prophets, and the Psalms, and any English Bible, and 90% of them, replace his name with the Lord. Every place that's Yod-Heh-Wah-Heh, which is Yahweh, they replace it with the Lord, Satan's name. That's ultimately negating his name. And the only ones that don't do that are those that replace it with Jehovah. There's no J and no V in Hebrew. His name most certainly was not Jehovah. And so here we have the Ark of God, which houses these 10 statements that were etched in stone. 7 additional statements, instructions to us on the second tablet. Beside the Ark of the Covenant, we're told by Yahweh, shall always reside the Torah. The scroll of the Torah is always set beside it so that we understand what it represents. And the Ark of the Covenant just doesn't hold the 10 statements. It isn't just a place to set the original autograph of the Torah. It's a seat. It's called a mercy seat. It's designed to be set upon. Why? Because it is our throne. It's our place to sit besides God. It is the place where the benefits of Pesach and Matzah are celebrated. It's a seat. And the back of that seat comes with wings. Why? Because when we benefit from Pesach and Matzah and become Yahweh's firstborn through Bikkurim, we gain wings. The equivalent of being a spiritual being. But it's the Ark of God, and he wanted a place for it to stand, and he pitched a tent, spreading it out for him. Ohel is the Hebrew word for tent. It's just a protective covering. So it's interesting that here's Dodi, he's building houses for himself. God thought that was just fine. And yet, his Ark of the Covenant is going to be placed under a tent. God thought that was fine too. Because why? Because God doesn't live here on earth. God doesn't need a house. In fact, the house that he would ultimately build is a house for the covenant, for the covenant's children. But we do need the mercy seat. And it should be open and approachable. Then Dodd said, one may approach or carry, no one may approach or carry the ark except the Lohim. In this, they were selected and chosen by Yahweh to approach, pick up, and carry the ark of Yahweh and render assistance to him forever and ever. Now, you said the ark ought to be approachable. And yes, it should be. And yes, Yahweh established the Lohi especially to do that. Because it isn't an ordinary thing. The Ark of the Covenant is set apart. It is special. It needs to be treated in a manner that recognizes its importance. And therefore, someone or individuals had to be designated and trained to explain all of the symbolism of the Ark of the Covenant. So people understood what it represents, how it becomes literally our throne to sit beside Almighty God. And so the Lohi were specifically designated. They were chosen by Yahweh to approach and to pick up and to carry the Ark of Yahweh and to render assistance to him forever and ever. God didn't want the Ark of the Covenant, for example, becoming part of a show and a tell experience. They didn't want it put in a religious context. He didn't want it abused. He wanted people to appreciate what it represents. The Lohi really had these two purposes. One is they would carry and serve as those that explained the purpose of the Ark of the Covenant, and they served to officiate over and to elucidate those who wish to partake in each of the Moed Mikre. And sadly, there are no priests in Judaism. There are no priests in Israel, not any Jewish priests anyway. There are lots of Catholic priests, and there are Christian priests. But the priesthood, the Lohi, are difficult even to identify today. And there's certainly none of them that serve in an official capacity. Now, rabbis took over. There was a battle, if you will, for control between rabbis and the loi, the priests who had been appointed by God, and the rabbis claimed control for themselves. This goes on to say that then Dod gathered all of Yisrael, and that's the thing that's interesting about Dod, is that under his reign, all of Yisrael was united. It's one of the reasons God says that the kingdom of Dod shall be reestablished at the end. What the kingdom of Dod represents is the united Yisrael. That means Yehudah and Yisrael together. Now, following his son Solomon, Yisrael and Yehudah separated. And they won't be reunited again until just before Yahweh's return. So a reunited Yehudah and Yisrael is God's idea of the way that the covenant relationship ought to exist. So Dod gathered all of Yisrael to Jerusalem to bring up the Ark of Yahweh to its standing place and home, which relationally and beneficially he had prepared. Remember, he had purchased it from Aruna, the Yabusi. And after having done so, he took the threshing floor and prepared it for the ark, and had created a tent for it to sit under then. And when it came to exist, when Dod was settled and living in his home, Dod said to Nathan means gift in Hebrew, the prophet, "Look, I am living in a house constructed of large cedar trees, but the Ark of the Covenant of Yahweh is under a tent." Now, what's interesting here is a couple of things. One is, who does the covenant belong to? The Ark of the Covenant of Yahweh. This is Aaron Bereth. So the Ark of the Covenant is Yahweh. The covenant is Yahweh's. It isn't Paul's to do away with or to create a new one. It isn't Christianity's prerogative to ignore Yahweh's covenant and to create their own new covenant, which they call their New Testament. This is the Ark of the Covenant of Yahweh. Now, Dod recognized, and he was uncomfortable with the fact that, you know, he's only empowered because God enabled him to be so. And he's living in a beautiful home, you know, in a beautiful city, on a beautiful ridge, and has all of these riches and wealth around him. And the most valuable two things in the universe, the original autograph of the Torah and the Ark of the Covenant and its 10 statements that are etched in stone, are all sitting up there on a little higher on the ridge, on the threshing floor, under a tent. But God wasn't concerned. That was just fine. God doesn't need a home. There is nothing we can build for God that's going to impress him. He is a seven-dimensional being. We're trapped in 3D. The best we can do in 3D is a pittance compared to what he can do in seven dimensions. But what God wants is for us to be comfortable. He wants us to enjoy family. And so it was totally appropriate for Dod to have a home made of cedar, and for Yahweh to be out there in the breeze under a colorful tent. And so Dod said to Nathan, and it's interesting here, that there was a time when Dod was the single most prolific, articulate, and insightful spokesperson, prophet, that had ever been inspired by God. No one wrote more, because he wrote most of the Psalms and most of the Proverbs. and his words are encapsulated in Shamuel and in Chronicles and Kings. There's so much that we know from this man. And yet all of it was during his youth, most of it before he became king. Once he was really comfortable and had, you know, all of this wealth and all of these women and all of this power and these beautiful, you know, places to live, Dode wasn't nearly as accessible to God, as willing to devote the time to God, wasn't as reliant on God. And so at this time, while he was still God's beloved son, he needed Nathan to communicate with Yahweh. And so Dode said to Nathan, act upon, engage, and do everything that relationally and beneficially is in your best judgment, because the Almighty is with you. Yeah. Imagine that. The most beloved son has to go to another man to find out what God wants done in this situation. And so it would be. This is the third and fourth statements in now 1 Chronicles 17. Then it happened during that same night that the word of God came to Nathan to say, walk and convey to Dode, the beloved, my associate. This is what Yahweh says. You yourself will not build for me the home to approach and to live. Now, this is interesting that the home is La Yeshab. This is the home to meet, to be restored, to be settled, to dwell and to abide. The purpose of the B-Y-T-H is to facilitate, to accommodate, to meet with, to protect those who are part of the Bereth, B-R-Y-T-H. The only difference in the two words is the addition of a Rosh, which is depicted as a person's head who is observant. So, Yahweh is saying, tell Dode, don't sweat it. You're not going to build the house for me. You're not going to build the home. And it's not a temple. It's not a shrine. This is not a religious building. It's a house. You're not going to build the home for me. Don't worry about it. That's profound. He says, hey, Dode, I got no issue with you having the big home. I'm not even going to talk to you about your promiscuity. Don't care. I'm glad you're happy. But you wanted to know my position on this issue, and I'm going to convey it to you. Don't worry, you're not going to build it. I don't need you and don't want you to build a home for me. Then the least pretentious being in the universe said, for indeed, I have not inhabited or remained in a house since the day, beneficially and relationally, to show the way, Asher, I lifted up Yisrael, even up to this discussion. And I have been from tent to tent and out of a tabernacle. That's amazing. You know, Yahweh went to Mitzrayim, the crucible of human oppression, Egypt. And there he was able, with an 80-year-old guy and a stick, to free the children of Yisrael from what was at the time the most powerful politically and military power on earth, the epicenter of religion on earth at the time. And he freed them. In fact, he not only freed them, he destroyed the Egyptian military in the process and rendered Egypt so impoverished that it would be under foreign rule for centuries. And as a parting gift out of town, the Egyptians lavished their former slaves with all manner of gifts. And then he took care of them. He fed them. He cared for them. Acted as a shepherd over them through the wilderness on the way to the promised land. And so, you know, I was saying, you know, from that moment, from the moment I came to lift Israel out of slavery, out of being so harshly treated by the Egyptians, all the way to this day of this very discussion, I have never asked for anything other than happy as a lark to have gone from tent to tent and now under a tabernacle, which is just a fancier tent. God's not pretentious. You know, the whole concept, too, is visual. God is a seven-dimensional creature, and therefore he is, his entirety is in the seventh dimension of the spiritual realm of what he refers to as heaven. And so for him to visit the earth, all he can do is send a diminished manifestation of himself, set apart an aspect of himself, diminish it for him to visit earth. And so at the very most, earth, being on earth, being in Yisrael, is camping out for God. It would be a million billion times more extreme than a man going to Mars and saying, I'm going to build a habitat there to camp out for a while on Mars. And so the idea of being in a tent, which is a temporary dwelling to camp out with his creation, is just the perfect depiction. And it ties so well into his Moed Mikre because six steps lead to the seventh, and the seventh is to camp out with God. Sukkah. It means to camp out together. So that was the whole symbolism. It's not just that God was content having the Ark of the Covenant, his means of meeting with and welcoming humankind into his presence, to be under a tent. That is, in fact, what he wanted. He didn't want anything more. That was the perfect symbolism for what he was trying to achieve. Moving on to Dabari Ha Yomem, words of the time, 1 Chronicles 17:6. It reads, during the entire relationship, when I walked with Yisrael, did I speak a word with so much as one of the shafat of the judges, those who adjudicate and lead by exercising good judgment to render reasonable decisions, of Yisrael, with whom I instructed to approach by shepherding my family, to ask, why haven't you built a house constructed of large cedar trees for me? No, I mean, one of the things that there's a whole lot of things I like about God's nature, but one of them is that He expects more from us than we seem to expect of ourselves. You know, I'm translating Yirmiyah 23. It's a real treat to do so. And there's a number of places where God makes a statement, and then one of the places he just says, you know, finally in the last days, someone's going to figure this out. And this is the method they're going to use to figure it out. And what God is saying here is, Dode, you should have figured this out. This isn't all that hard. All the evidence was there for you. You had access to the Torah. You had access to the book named after Yosha ben Nun. You had the book written by the judges. You were on a first name basis close to Shamuel. You had a wealth of information. You've read all of it. Don't you recognize? Didn't you make the connection that at no time did I ask for this? You know, if God doesn't ask for something, He doesn't want it. If God doesn't ask us to pray, He doesn't want us to pray. If God doesn't want us to bow down before Him, He doesn't want us to bow down before Him. If God doesn't ask for a shrine or a temple, He doesn't want a shrine or a temple. God is a master communicator. You know, over the course of the Torah and the subsequent prophets and writings, He conveyed an enormous amount of pertinent information about who He is, what He's offering, and what He expects in return. And never once did He ask anyone to build a house for Him. Yeah, there's a couple of places. Set up a stone to memorialize the place that this discussion occurred, because this discussion is important. And I want people to recognize that when I communicate with somebody, it's grounded in place and time. And I'm going to give you the details of where I met with my people and where they were led, because it is important to have a grounding in place and time. Prophecy is more than just a prediction of the future. It's getting the past right, too. And so here is God saying, I provided all of this information. Never once did I ask for anyone to build me a house made of cedar. So why are you asking Nathan to ask me what I want? I've already told you what I want. One of the things that bothers me so much about the Christian prayers, they want to know God's will for their lives. God's told you what He wants. Why not just listen to Him? And that's what God is saying here. If you just listened to me and thought about what I had said and what I did not say, you would know that I'm not looking for a house to be built out of fancy material. I'm not looking for a permanent structure. The tent is just fine, thank you. It is symbolic of what I'm trying to accomplish. It conveys the proper symbolism. You know, it's also why Yahweh's favorite titles, Ab, Father, and El, God, both begin with the depiction of a ram's head. Further, Father is written with the addition of a home, the floor plan of a home. And so it's the home of His sheep. And God, El, is written with the addition of a shepherd's staff. Well, God is the ram, the male lamb, and the shepherd's staff. And so it is the shepherd, in this case, is one of the sheep. He doesn't want to be this powerful being lording over us, but one of us. And the only way for that to happen is to make us like Him. So God is extraordinarily unpretentious in the titles that He has chosen for Himself and the symbolism of those titles, showing that He really wants to be with us. You know, you look at a sheep. A sheep doesn't even have a tent. They live in an open pasture. The view is great. You're always moving and exploring. And, of course, the sheep are protected by their shepherd. The next statement Yahweh conveyed is, so then, this is what you should say to my associate and co-worker, Dod. Now, co-worker and associate, Ebed, is an interesting term here, of course, because Yahweh does not like to work alone. Could he? Sure. But he doesn't. You know, could Yahweh have gone to Mitzrayim, to Pharaoh, and say, you know, I might as well get this over with. I'm taking the children of Israel out of here, and, I'm going to just destroy you, because there's no reason for me to ask you anything. But I'm going to destroy Egypt and your army and all of that, and we're just going to go. Good riddance. Could have done that. But he didn't do that. No. What did he do? He went and found an old, broken-down, 80-year-old shepherd, Moshe, and said, come on, let's go do this together. And then he could have provided a way for every human who ever lived to know his Torah. He could be shouting it as a record. It's over and over and over again from the mountaintops. He could have put it as part of our DNA. But no. He picked this 80-year-old man and said, I'm going to dictate it to you. Write it down for me and convey it to the people. Set it beside this Ark of the Covenant. Communicate it. Teach it. Follow it. Observe it. He likes to work through people. So Dode was someone he liked to work through. What did he do with Dode? Well, he slayed the person that was blaspheming him and trying to kill his children. And Goliath with a single stone. What did he do with Dode? He showed that with Yahweh's protection, even if the king and his military are opposed to you, you're safe. Dode didn't have to have a gun. He didn't have to have a bunker, a doomsday bunker. No. God protected him. Even when Shaul, the people's choice, and Shaul's military sought to do him in. And what was the result? Dode came to know and rely on Yahweh, and he wrote the most insightful songs ever recorded. No one has provided more useful information pertinent to knowing who Yahweh is and how to engage in a relationship with him and to benefit from it than Dode. And what is more important than that, I would ask you. And so that is how they worked together. So then, this is what you should say to my associate and co-worker, Dode, the beloved. Thus says Yahweh of the spiritual envoys, I took you from the pasture, following after the sheep, to be a leader unto Yisrael, my family. All right. Interesting metaphor. Yahweh says, you know, you're asking me, you know, about what you should do in terms of building me this, you know, fancy house. Because you have a fancy house. And keep in mind, I met with you when you were a lowly shepherd. I met with you out there in that pasture. That's where I found you. We had good times, didn't we? In the pasture. And I, as God, not only met with you in that pasture, I took you from that pasture, from following after sheep. Because what? Is that not the perfect training? Yahweh refers to himself as our shepherd. You know, it's how he depicts himself with the Ab and El as the as a sheep and with El as with the shepherd's staff. So a shepherd was the perfect occupation. It was the occupation that, of course, Moshe had for 40 years prior to Yahweh engaging with him to free the people from Egypt. Because the issue wasn't, how am I militarily going to conquer Egypt and liberate the people? That part was easy. God was going to do that. The hard part was shepherding this wayward flock across the wilderness and into the promised land, of which being a shepherd equipped Moshe perfectly to accomplish. Yahweh wanted Dode to shepherd his people. That means to lead them, to guide them, to care for them, to live with them, to take them to the perfect pasture, which he did in Jerusalem. And so God is saying, I took you from the pasture and from following after sheep to be what? A leader.
Thank you for listening to GCN. Be sure to visit GCNlive.com today.
Well, this tells us that God does indeed see the virtues, the skills one learns as a shepherd, to be the ideal skill set to be a leader in his family. He doesn't want us to be scholarly. He didn't say, I picked you because you were the smartest dude on the planet. I didn't pick you because you were the most literate. I didn't pick you because you were the strongest, because you were the most articulate. And no, I picked you because you were a shepherd. And that's the skill set that is most desirable when guiding my family. And, of course, Yisrael here is described as Yahweh's family. So for those who are anti-Semitic, for those who would oppose Israel in any way, you need to know that Israel is Yahweh's family. And as such, that's a really foolish thing to do. God says, I have been with you in every one of the steps which beneficially gave meaning to life as a result of the relationship that you have walked, and I have cut off all of your foes from your presence. So I will engage acting to create for you a name akin and consistent with the name of the most set apart ones of the land. Well, God sent you. All right, Doug, I've been with you every step of the way. I've kept you safe. I've kept your enemies at bay. And I'm here to tell you that I'm going to create a name for you that's akin to the name of the most set apart ones of the land. Who are the most set apart ones? Well, if we expand the land to the earth, it would be Adam, Noah. And if the land is quantified as Yisrael, and, of course, Abraham, the father of the covenant. And Jacob. Now, Jacob became Yisrael. Shemuel, who was so vitally important in communicating to humankind, particularly about the problems associated with human governance and human religious choices. And yet, Dode's name rivals theirs. God wanted us to know his name. So I would ask, what does the name Dode mean? Why is that important? And of course, the name means beloved. And interesting, too, that the root of Dode is actually boiling over. It means that the love that Yahweh has for Dode, and vice versa, the love that Dode had for Yahweh, was passionate, fervent, boiling over. God's has always liked people who are passionate. You know, in the movies we see the flawed rascal. Well, the rascal is always a passionate individual. They care deeply, and that's what Yahweh likes. He chooses to spend his time around flawed rascals. Then he says, this is words of our time, 1 Chronicles 17:9. I will appoint and bring about a place to dwell and to take a stand for my family, Yisrael. And I will plant them so that they might live inhabiting this place under him. And he will not be agitated or anguished ever again. So the sons of injustice will not continue to wear him down as it was in the beginning. You know, part of what happened with Dode is that he became a man of war. And he was constantly fighting Israel's battles. And after time, it wore him down. And I would say also that having experienced some of the events of the last few months, I can appreciate this a bit. Well, Moshe certainly experienced it. You know, after a while, when you're conveying Yahweh's testimony, you're standing apart from all others, explaining how marvelous this relationship is, people have other ideas. Other people seek power. You know, look what Aaron and Miriam did with Moshe. You know, other people, look what Shaul did with Dod. Over time, you'll find foes, people who are averse to you. And it's draining. It wears you down. And Dod was a bit worn out. It had been a long time since he had been a shepherd. A long time since he and Yahweh had written all of those lyrics to the beautiful Psalms. And so God is just saying, you know, that I'm going to do whatever is required to for my family. And I'll take a stand on behalf of my family, which in fact he did. And he said, I'm going to plant them. God loves horticultural metaphors so that they might live inhabiting this very place. And those who are unjust will not prevail against them. Now, ultimately, God's going to return his children to Yisrael. And he uses the branch metaphor, Shemek, over and over again to talk about how when he brings them back, they're going to grow, they're going to flourish. They're going to experience abundant life. That's what he's talking about here. Appropriately, God says from time to time, when to show the way to the beneficial relationship, I appointed and instructed the judges on account of my family, Israel. I have humbled and subdued all of your rancorous adversaries accordingly. Furthermore, I declare unambiguously before you, the house of Yahweh, the house for you, I should say, Yahweh will build to establish his family. God is continuing to say all throughout time, and not just during Dod's period, but also during the period that the judges prevailed, the Shaphat, and all four on the benefit of Yisrael, Yahweh's family. The enemies of Yisrael, the foes of his family, have been subdued. And God promises to protect us if we rely on him. Look what Hezekiah did when they celebrated Pesach and Matzah and Bukkurim. For not 1 week, but for 2 weeks, and the 180,000 Assyrian troops just died outside of their gates. So God is saying, I'm going to declare unambiguously before you that the house that I'm going to build is going to be for you. God's not building the house for himself. He does not need a house. You know, this is not like the Kaaba, which is a rock pile with a black stone in the middle of it for everyone to bow around. It's not a shrine to Allah. No, I'm going to build the house for you. And Yahweh is going to establish his family. And that is indeed what's important, because ultimately, when Yahweh returns, all of the crud that is now so prevalent, religious and political and military pollution, that is so destructive and so just profane in Israel and particularly in Jerusalem, is going to be wiped away. And then Yahweh is going to build his house for his family on the summit of Mount Moriah. He doesn't need our help doing it. And it's for our benefit, not for his. This is in the 11th statement of 1 Chronicles 17. And it will occur at another time when your days are fulfilled, toward the time that you walk with your fathers. Yes, indeed. Yahweh is going to do it. His time.